Welcome back to the Visions of a Better World podcast. And today we are continuing our conversation with Heikki Otamäki, a professor of
world politics and global political economy
from University of Helsinki. And we are now joined as well by Professor Teivo Teivonen, a professor of world politics, also from the University of Helsinki. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here. Such a cozy studio you have here.
Exactly. So we have already been discussing the concept of a world state and Heikki's latest book, World Statehood, but you co-authored a book together exactly 20 years ago this year, in 2004, titled A Possible World, Democratic Transformation and Global Institutions. And one of the questions that we have specifically for both of you is, what has changed since you guys wrote your book 20 years ago? Do you have any, like...
Teivo, you can start, but I have to say that the book was actually written in 2001 and 2.
Oh.
And the first version came out in Finnish in 2003, and it was translated into different languages, and the English version came out in 2004.
Yeah, true. Though we wrote it first in English.
It was translated into Finnish.
Yeah, and it was published also in Arabic and in Spanish.
That's right, and part of it in Swedish as well.
So what has happened then? Of course, at that time, that was just before, a few years before the major financial crisis in the latter part of that decade. So that's one thing that changed a little bit. At least it seemed to change some of the conversations on economic policies and all that. I remember at that time I was sometimes surprised, like in the book we talked about several international organizations and, for example, the governance of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund and all that. And a few years later, some people were saying, like in Finland, like, well, actually, International Monetary Fund has a much better and more rational economic policies than the Finnish government at that moment, which was something funny to note that some people who had been active in the kinds of movements we perhaps also described there had this perception at that time. But that was one of the big things that happened soon after the different editions of the book came out. Of course, also there at that time when we wrote the book, there was perhaps more optimism about social movements coming together and creating alliances and creating platforms and the World Social Forum and things like that. And then as often happens, you know, once you have this thing, you are opposed to something and then you'd say, yes, there's an alternative. Another world is possible, but then when people actually start debating what does that other world look like and how do we get there, then the kind of unity of being together and creating something gets a little bit more complicated because people don't necessarily, it's easier to agree on what you're opposed to than to agree on what you need to construct.
I mean, some of the things they were said would be part of my answer as well, particularly, I mean, the waning of optimism of the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, there was a period when global civil society was rising and we very much took part in those discussions. I mean, that was the whole idea, to develop some kind of a strategy for global democratization for global civil society. I mean, that was very much part of the idea. And going through the existing institutions and all the major initiatives to develop new, better institutions as well. So we assessed these initiatives quite systematically, and then the idea was to develop a strategy. That strategy was already anachronistic by the end of the decade. I mean, so by 2010, I mean, I didn't see any possibility for realize anything like that. And the reason is that in the early 2000s, there was a conservative turn in world politics. It had many reasons or many causes, and it also had many manifestations. The most visible one was, of course, the election of George W. Bush in the United States as the president of the U.S. I mean, they started to advocate what could be called explicit neo-imperialism, that the U.S. is leading the world and they can do things in a manner that is a little reminiscent of what the British did in the 19th century and early 20th century. Then came 9/11 and the global war on terror, Afghanistan, Iraq. all the rest of it. And of course, I mean, there were other things happening at the same time. Some countries like Russia started to be increasingly critical of what's going on. And they also responded to things like the color revolutions as well. So there started to be all kinds of cracks in this neoliberal New World Order in the early 2000s. And taking the world into a more conservative direction in many ways. I mean, if you look at, for instance, the issue of arms expenditure or the waning of war, I mean, hope for some sort of a permanent peace after the end of the Cold War. By 2000, the world had already returned to the earlier levels of armaments, not in absolute terms, but in relative terms. 15 years later, in the 2010s, I mean, the return was also in absolute terms as well. So there was this conservative turn. There were all kinds of other background things. I can't go through all of them here. But after that time, I mean, there was what I call a saddle point in world politics. By the global financial crisis of 2007-09, I mean, the response was not the rise of new emancipatory movements on a global scale. The response was more in line with the nationalist authoritarian populism across the world.
What are your thoughts then about a possible new strategy for positive change today? What could it look like? How could we solve the problems of today in a new way?
Well, there are one thing I've been wondering in now, especially now there's this BRICS meeting happening right as we speak, and what extent their sort of perceived need to do something about the demands of the global south, or however it is called, that you see now in sort of slightly unexpected quarters, even like something, I don't know if this is a reason for optimism, but to have like, right-wing president of the Republic in Finland speaking about reform of the United Nations and Security Council and more voice to Africa, and even hinting at, you know, more voice to the South and votes to the South in IMF and the World Bank. There's something weird there, you know, something that somebody like Heikki or myself would have said, and maybe we did some of these things like 10 years ago. It would have been you communist utopians speaking your bullshit, and now it's the, you know, right-wing president of the Republic is actually saying this. Of course, we could see that this is mere tactic to get Finland to the Security Council for the non-permanent seat and convincing Africans like we want, you know, so much more powers to you and all that, but there's something. And is that something, to what extent the emergence of constellations like BRICS that we have today plays a role? And I have an analogy. Analogies are almost by definition almost often bad. So is it a little bit like the Soviet Union in the old times? In the old times, Soviet Union, and I mind you, I was never in any ways sympathetic towards the way things were run in the Soviet Union. But one thing many people probably would agree, that the existence of the Soviet Union meant that in Western Europe, the rulers had to, or it was an incentive and it was a cause for them doing some reforms where the working class would get a little bit better conditions of life and perhaps a little bit more take in the decision making of the system and social welfare, so that they wouldn't go communist. So this was like reforms in order not to make working classes be seduced by the communists. So in some sense, now vis-a-vis the global south, you have so many people, and it's surprising, foreign ministers in the establishment talking, yes, we are competing with China and Russia, and now the global south decides the game between the east and the west. Something like that. This is like Alexander Stubbs kind of lines he often throws. And therefore, we need to take more seriously their demands to have more power in international institutions. So this is happening in ways that were not so obvious before. Of course, before when we wrote the book, there was like Boutros Ghali, the UN Secretary General, had been talking about United Nations reform and all that. But now it seems to have come back with a little bit more momentum. And I don't know, I'm curious, Heikki, how do you see that? Is it just, you know, are they just bullshitting there, or is something going on?
I think I have a slightly different historical reading of this. First of all, I mean, the Security Council reform has been discussed at least for 35 years.
Yes, yes, now, but now it seems to have come actually, back in with more momentum.
Working together with Tapio Kaninen, he used to be the chief of the policy unit of the Department of Political Affairs of the UN, and he was actually the secretary of the committee that was discussing UN Security Council reforms for many years. It was always the West that was totally opposed to this, particularly the US. And it still continues to be the case. The US is totally unresponsive to any calls to reform any of the existing international institutions in terms of voting powers or anything else. My reading of that discussion about the UN reform is that there's a desire in some corners to, at this particular moment when conflicts are pretty intense in world politics, to exclude Russia and possibly also China from the Security Council, or at least take away their veto power. And my sense is that under the current circumstances, I mean, the U.S. actually serves a very positive function, that even though it's an anachronism in a wider world historical terms, at this particular moment where there's a real threat of escalation into a nuclear war, the U.N. Security Council as it stands is one of the few places where there's still at least the possibility of some kind of a dialogue between these different parties. And in that context, I wouldn't start by reforming the UN Security Council. I think there are much better initiatives to change the world system, including global taxes, the idea of World Parliament, the International Clearing Union, and others that we've been discussing here.
You can comment, David, but I have a question that I want to relate to this and ask you. But we have discussed with Heikki a lot about these big powers and on the scale of states and governments. But then your expertise, of course, is these social movements and the power of social movements. And what do you see if we talk about change and the changes we want to see in the world, and how much change has happened perhaps in the last 20 years that sparked from a smaller movement, you know, something that's started as a small idea that has become mainstream, and how can that affect world politics? And then, of course, maybe relating later, we could, if we have time, to discuss your joint views on the idea of this world parliament. But these social movements and these smaller non-big governments or non-big powerful actors, then how do they, what kind of possibilities have they had to shape world politics as well and the directions we've been going?
Yeah, great questions. Maybe about Heikki's, just to respond to or reflect on both. Yeah, maybe you're right. Of course, the Security Council reform is not something that would resolve things, and it might have some, depending on how it's done, counter some effects that may not be desired there. There are, this veto power thing, of course, I don't think it's very feasible that they could get veto power away from only from China and Russia now. Of course, they could try, but I see that difficult. But there are these mechanisms that I actually find perhaps interesting in countering the veto power use, that are like realizing mechanisms that sort of already exist, where if there's a stalemate because of the veto power, then it can be taken to the General Assembly of the United Nations. And that's one road towards sort of reforming something there. Also about the UN, about the United States, I think I read somewhere, I might be wrong, but US ambassador in the United Nations giving a speech where she was at least speaking very nicely of giving Africa space there and something. So reforms like this might be a little bit more in the agenda there. So there, of course, as you said, the UN reform and even Security Council reform was always in the agenda in the internal discussions of the UN and also in the Global South. But the new thing here, as what I meant, was that you have right-wing politicians in places like Finland and other European countries talking about it. But the social movements, it's as we talked now, the optimism of 20 years ago of, you know, social movements coming and giving innovations and all that. is going to change the world, and we mostly realize it didn't happen in the way some were expecting. But sometimes you know things happen. It's the impact is very difficult to measure. Like, what impact did the social movements have? As Heikki knows more, because he knows very much about philosophy of studying causality. He's in world politics, so causality is very hard to prove. What do social movements going and doing things, and what's the impact there? So I'm trying to think of what kinds of... First of all, there are some impacts. Like, sometimes you have, for example, in Brazil and then other parts in Latin America, there were these... big mobilizations later that started with people focusing on the price of municipal tickets, bus tickets and subway tickets. And everybody was like, oh, they came out of nowhere. And then you start looking at, no, they actually came from this movement that was established in a World Social Forum, like, you know, 8 years before, and in this meeting. And it was this network that was keeping the idea there of free travel in municipal buses and organizing around it. And suddenly this thing sparked a huge sort of mobilization, which then again didn't necessarily lead to that much, but it was an example of that. Sometimes we think like it's just been bullshitting there and they don't get anything done. So it's hard to measure and sort of locate the causalities, like why did this have an impact on that? But I think even this UN reform and whether they are good or whether they should be in the Security Council or somewhere else are things where social movements, and when we say social movements, sometimes we romanticize women. There are like social movements that are these massive, like what would be like landless rural workers, authentic. And then there are these NGOs that are bureaucratic and I don't see the dichotomy in overly dichotomical terms there. But you know, they keep these ideas around and they exist and people write books or people discuss them and it seems like nobody cares. And then when there are other mechanisms that cause those ideas to become relevant again, or like the stuff Heikki has been working on now with that have to do with global financial matters and currencies and clearing unions and stuff. You know, unless somebody keeps them alive and has a debate, then of course the possibility to emerge when the conditions are ripe are not there, then they wouldn't. So they are like, they can be seen as necessary, but not sufficient conditions for the emergence and realization of these ideas. But, you know, one issue I've been studying a little bit is this, what is sometimes called sort of corporate social responsibility and ESG and all that kind of stuff, like which can be seen as a very lame, superficial response to the demands related to the power of big corporations. Organizations and movements that some have been saying, like, you know, let's get rid of the corporations, and some have been saying let's make the corporations more responsible, and somehow both kinds of movements have probably been useful in creating a situation where, for example, this year it might not be so much, but in the European Union there was this new sort of regulation on Artificial Intelligence, AI Act, which is not that great, but still is a step towards creating regulation of big tech firms. And maybe it will lead somewhere, but it wouldn't be there unless there had been social movements working on the ideas of how the corporations have power, and others working on what kinds of initiatives can be used to either make them better or replace them with something else. But unfortunately, perhaps many of the ideas that, for example, we talked about in our books, that many came from social movements in the sort of wide sense of the term, have not been realized.
I was thinking about the past elections we just had in Finland, the European elections, where the idea, everyone said that it was going to be big gains for our more populist-leaning party, the Finns, but actually it was this leftist Party and the young voters who very much want kind of, they are biggest, Lee Anderson was the most successful politician in that election, or she like the most successful politician and had received the most votes in most recent elections. So, but there, lots of those policies, of course, and the ideas are now blended more from, many of the ideas probably come from social movements and these. And this was kind of a big counter thing that happened in compared to what was thought would happen, of course. And we now have an election coming up in a couple of weeks, a world election where it will be interesting to see what happens. But I think this idea of world parliament, and Heikki already explained that this is a big innovation from the European Union, that we have these parties within the EU, like the Left Alliance and these other ones. Then what are your thoughts, both of you, again, to return to this idea then of world parliament and representation? And what if all of these social movements around the world were maybe the younger generations who care, for example, about the fight against climate change and these transnational movements? Could they unite with that type of world parliament, world political party systems?
Of course they could. Will they? I'm not sure. I think one thing in what happened with the movements also in the earlier decades was that this idea of representation in the sense of sort of representative democracy was sometimes seen, oh, it's so old-fashioned and that's part of the old-style way of doing things. We have to have direct and participatory mechanisms and not representation and not representative mechanisms. And actually some organizations, I don't, this is not a conspiracy theory or any, but like looking at like how the World Bank kind of organizations were actually promoting participation everywhere and sort of, at least my feeling at the time was, you have World Bank telling non-governmental organizations, yes, focus on participation. Participation is good, and representative mechanisms, you know, it's so last year to think about representation. And I was thinking, yeah, because the World Bank doesn't want anybody talking about their mechanisms of representation. So it's actually people only talking about participation and not focusing on representation leaves the powers with too many places to hide. And so I think then, of course, World Parliament sounds to many like, oh, if the European Parliament is such a mess or whatever, then how could something bigger happen? And sometimes I think it's the question of scales here. Sometimes we think, okay, you have municipal parliaments, then you have national, and then you have European Parliament. And people look at the European Parliament, oh, there are so many problems. So probably there are many more problems in a global level of, you know, making decisions, if even in Europe it's so bureaucratic and, you know, all that. And I tend to think that actually European level and national level are more or less the same. I mean, the same also in the sense that they are governing sort of a territory that has inside and outside, and that creates many of the problems. This would get too complicated political theory here, but then they have to sort of defend in the, not only in the national defense sense, but sort of in the sense of interests and the companies and regulation and companies escaping regulation and all that. So they have to think about the external boundary all the time. So national and European parliaments are actually pretty much the same. So global parliament would be a totally new ballgame. Also because it would not have this, at least in the same sense, this thing about inside and outside. So we often think global parliaments are, you know, that would be too much, too bureaucratic or something. But I think they could, global mechanisms of control, whether you want to call that state or not, world state, we can talk about that concept, because states have existed as part of interstate systems. So this global mechanisms of governance, how to call them, but in any case, so, and actually when you come to think about it, it's a very simple idea. We have, you know, I have an iPhone here. It's much, much more complicated system than a world parliament would be in terms of mechanisms. So it's very easy to imagine how to create a world parliament and the number of people, and including then world referendums and stuff like that, that we also talked about in that book. So I think in terms of, you know, complications, world parliament is kind of not so difficult to imagine compared to what kinds of things we imagine. Have you asked these chat GPTs and others, like how would these new AI algorithm systems, what kind of world parliament would they design? Design me the most democratic world parliament. What would it look like? All listeners, please go now and ask your favorite AI this. Mm.
The large language models, I mean, they, of course, go through various texts available on the internet, including ours.
Yeah.
How surprising will the answer be? Anyway, first of all, about the movements. I mean, in the modern world, particularly since the 19th century, all the institutions that we have in place, I mean, particularly those built since then, have been based on ideas that have been constitutive of movements of some sort that then have manifested themselves in various kinds of organizations, including political parties, including trade unions, including all kinds of new things. I mean, just think about, for instance, peace movement. I mean, the big conferences, the Hague and others in the late 19th century, early 20th century, they paved the way for the League of Nations, obviously. But much later, I mean, during the Franco-German War, it came up an idea about an international criminal court. Mm. And that was then realized in very different circumstances in the 1990s. So there was a long movement and a long campaign for something like an international criminal court. And eventually it was able to realize a version of that idea. Mm. And this is true almost of any institution that we have in place in the contemporary world. In that sense, one can say that beyond any claim about any particular movement having a particular effect in the world, we can say that, I mean, these movements and these ideas are constitutive of world-making projects. They make worlds. Of course, not all of them are successful. It depends on causal processes that are not under their control, and there are many other things that we need to take into account when explaining the outcome. But anyway, that's the key thing. Regarding world parliament, I think the main thing is to think about what kinds of powers the world parliament could have. It's easy to organize a system whereby there's some form of representation, whether by direct elections or otherwise. But the problem is, I mean, what kinds of powers could the world parliament have? And typically there have been only two options. I mean, one is that it's only a symbolic place to talk and nothing more. And this is like the European Parliament used to be when it started, more or less. And there are parliamentary assemblies in some other international organizations as well. The second possibility is like a full legislative body that has sovereign powers to legislate whatever it wants, and also decides upon the budget of the world or something like that, if there was one. But there isn't. But anyway, so I think these two options are not particularly feasible or plausible. And my idea is something quite different, that it's a combination, as we already discussed earlier, of something like a democratically elected Supreme Court of the world deciding what the international law and later cosmopolitan law is. And secondly, it would be a coordinating body of different functional organizations as well. It could also be a body that has the legitimate authority to speak in the name or on behalf of the humanity as a whole, or planet as a whole. I mean, now we have some states, particularly capitals like London and Washington, tend to assume the authority to speak in the name of the international community. If we really had a world parliament, then we would have a legitimate body that could speak in the name of the world community in a totally different way. And I have to say that this also has kind of a cosmic counterpart as well, because there are many things that we have to decide also on behalf of the planet as a whole, its biosphere, etc. And we are also meeting and going to encounter however primitive forms of life coming outside the planet Earth. We are expanding into the space, and there's even possibility that someday we will find out that we are not alone in the galaxy or in the universe. I mean, who is going to speak in the name of humanity then?
Thank you, Hick.
Yeah, good, important points. I pretty much agree. maybe about this representation. Sometimes we think like, wow, that's, you know, global, to have a democratic global governance would mean like global Stalinism or something, and they would decide on us and all. But we already have so much decision making that is centralized and on transnational and often pretty global level. So it's not so much from going like there's no centralized governance in the global spheres to like making it more democratic could actually even mean that there would be less control by global and transnational institutions, because there already is, we just don't see it as control because it's camouflaged as, you know, sort of free market or things like that. And in representation, one dimension I've been looking at recently is, you know, we think about corporate, I'm thinking about global representation or representative organs that would operate globally, like how is that possible? Actually, we have many representative organizations operating globally. They are transnational corporations. They are mechanisms that are representative. The thing is, the representation is not democratic. But we often, for example, when there was no election in Finland because of our elections were postponed when the pandemic, COVID pandemic started, and I was making half tongue-in-cheek, but serious. Yes, there's an important election. UPM company is having an election. And then I was like following it. And it has voters. Mm. It's not citizens, it's shareholders. And they elect representatives. It's not the parliament, it's the board. But in any case, it's elected by the electorate. They have people who count votes. And then the parliament or the board elects the executive sector, the CEO and other directors or the cabinet here. So it's actually very similar representative mechanism, and this is true of many big corporations, but we never think of it as representative system, because if we did, we would understand that it's a political system, because when we see representation, we understand better that it's about political things, because representational elections are political. It's easy to understand. So I think by understanding that global corporations actually are representative mechanisms, they are just non-democratically representative. It's $1, one vote kind of, or one share, one vote kind of system. It might make it easier to imagine that something like other ways of representation, like we could call them global parliament or some other assemblies transnationally, that they wouldn't really be such a huge change from when there's nothing on the global level and then we create something, but that there actually is quite a lot already happening there and decision making, and it's even representative, it's just not democratically representative, and therefore.
But perhaps it is that the people are associating the term representative with democratic representation, that they don't think, it's not that it's not political or that they don't recognize corporations as political, but it's rather that they don't recognize it as being representative, because it's not representing people or citizens, but it is representing money.
But it's representing people with money according to the thickness of their wallets. I mean, people want, I agree with you, that's how we normally think, but I think if we think about it, it is, there is a mechanism of representation in the corporations.
Yeah, technically speaking, that's true. But I mean, but there is a kind of a common understanding of what representation actually means, but that's a side remark.
My point is that common understanding is the problem, is one problem there, like if it was understood that they are actually mechanisms of representation, then it could be easier to understand that they are political, that they yield politically meaningful power, and then it would be easier to have a political debate about power of corporations.
Well, thank you. I think we're nearing the very end now, but what we actually, I think you're both kind of arguing in the same way, is that lots of these mechanisms and the idea of a world government or world governing or world statehoods, then they do exist in small ways already, as you both kind of have in your own ways explained. These things may already exist, but then it comes to how, instead of fearing it, then it just comes to maybe creating a sustainable way for it to exist in the future, and a way with consensus of absolutely everyone, which is, of course, the ideal goal. If we want to represent humanity in a government forum, then we want to include all of humanity, which will be the big issue. And now we have an exciting moment in the world as we see what happens with BRICS. They are expected, I think I read, to actually surpass the Western economies. If they come together, they're supposed to be leading in the future. And that will be a big shift. And then we're going to see what's happening in a couple of weeks in America, in the US elections, which will be a big shift. And we will be seeing Heikki actually in December.
And then
we will be able to hear your thoughts on this that election and the results. But thank you very much, everyone, for being here.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.